This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. I am Ari Barbalat, your host today with the New Books in Israel Studies podcast, part of the New Books Network series of podcasts interviewing authors of new books throughout the social sciences and humanities. I'm honored to be in dialogue with my guest today, Dr. Anders Persson. He is an associate professor of political science at Linnaeus University, just located just outside of Malmo, Sweden. We will be discussing his new book, EU Diplomacy and the Israeli-Arab Conflict, 1967 to 2019, published by Edinburgh University Press, 2020. Anders, it's a privilege to be in your presence today. Thank you.
Thanks, Ari. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be on.
Thank you. It's great to be with you. Please tell us a bit about yourself. Where did you grow up? Where did you go to university and graduate school?
I grew up here in the south of Sweden in a small city located 40 kilometers north of Malmo. So I did my undergraduate work at Malmo University. Then I did my PhD at Lund University, which is a bigger Swedish university. I wrote about the role of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the European Union and the role of the EU in the conflict. Then I did my postdoc at University of Copenhagen in Denmark, looking more specifically at the EU's normative power and normative instruments and declarations in the conflict. And now I am a tenured associate professor at a small university called Linnaeus University, a bit north of Malmo.
Wonderful. How did you become interested in the topic of EU-Israeli relations?
It's a very long story, actually. I grew up in a working class home. Both of my parents were factory workers, and none had any connections whatsoever to the Middle East or to anything political or religious for that matter, a completely apolitical and non-religious home. So I'm a very sort of strange bird in that sense, but it began when I was a kid. I was 11 years old, went with my class to the local library. The teacher told all the kids, you know, get a book to read. And all sort of the books for young men were other people had borrowed them. So I went into the adult section and picked a book on political violence. It was actually left-wing terrorism in Germany in the 1970s.
Interesting.
But my mind was completely mesmerized by the idea how you can kill other people for your political, ideological, or religious convictions. This was in the mid-1990s, and just a year after Hamas in Gaza and West Bank started off a major wave of suicide bombings against Israel. So my teenage mind was obsessed by the question, not only why people can kill others for their beliefs, but why they can kill themselves.
Wow.
So those two questions of why people kill others and why they kill themselves have followed me through life up until this day. Now, this, the mid-1990s, was a time when, you know, great optimism, and my parents told me to get, you know, a proper education, to get a proper job. So I started studying economy at the university, and I started the 1st of September 2001, and 10 days later the 9/11 attacks took place, and they opened up a world for people like me. So I went to the Middle East. I stayed in a kibbutz in Israel for a while and went back and sort of pursued degrees in topics that I really liked.
Wonderful. You alluded to growing up in and around Malmo, and your university is just on the outskirts of Malmo. Before getting into the content questions, I'd be curious to ask your assessment of why Malmö is so ripe for the radicalism that has taken place there and caught the attention of the news. What's unique about Malmö that makes it susceptible to the radicalism that has taken place? And what's unique about the populations that live there that make it ripe for the kinds of headlines that have come out of Malmö?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. It's a very interesting city. For a researcher, I spend a lot of time there, and I think a lot sort of the dynamics that are going on in Malmö at the moment and has been going on there for quite a while. It has always been an immigrant city. So it took in a lot of refugees in different waves, took in a lot of refugees, Jewish refugees after World War II, and then Hungarians after the uprising in Hungary in 56 from Schiele in 73, and a lot of Palestinians after the first Lebanon War of 1982. And then other Muslims and Arabs came from Iraq and from Syria and from other places. So it has a big Palestinian and other Arab population today, which I think is one of the reasons why it has problems with anti-Semitism. We have other cities in Sweden with other immigrant communities, which has much less problems with anti-Semitism. So I think the fact that we have a significant Palestinian minority there is sort of one of the keys to understanding this. And of course, Palestinian and other Arabs, they are one of sort of the voting bases for the left-wing Labour Party here in Sweden. So there is an alliance between those communities, which I think is also part of the problems of anti-Semitism in Malmö, has been for a couple of years now. I think it's also worth mentioning that despite, you know, Malmö's problems with radicalism, anti-Semitism, violence and crime in general, a very striking feature is that it has sent very few people to Syria and Iraq, much fewer than the other big Swedish cities, which of course prompts the question of why. And that is an open question at the moment, which I think is a perfect question for somebody, say a young person, you know, writing a PhD or something like that. But it has been speculated that Malmö is radical enough so that people have no need to go to Syria.
Fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. As we go into the content questions pertaining to your book, I was struck by your discussion in your introduction about the importance of international relations theory and theories. What role did theories of international relations play in your analysis of EU-Israeli relations? Are any specific theories and approaches to international relations most helpful to analyze EU foreign policy in general and its attitude towards the Middle East in particular? Do you feel that we need a combination of theories to understand what's going on in EU Middle East relations and EU policy towards Israel and the Palestinians?
Yeah, we absolutely need a plurality of international relations theories for analyzing, I think, this problem and many others. And I think people should be open to applying different perspectives on a case. I depart from sort of political realism, meaning that national interests, security, rivalry, struggle over resources, and sort of these form the base of the EU's involvement here. But many factors from liberalism, say the UN system, international law, democracy promotion, trade, interdependence, support for NGOs, regional cooperation, these are also very important factors of the EU's involvement in the conflict. And there are many examples of that. And from, say, constructivism and more critical perspective, we can take concepts like discourse analysis, narratives, agencies, different perceptions, and also sort of different conceptions of power and what it is and how you apply it. So these three big and broad theoretical perspectives all contribute to my analysis. And then it would be possible to add even further perspectives, but I didn't do that.
How did the particular approaches of Javier Solana, Catherine Ashton, and Federica Mogherini toward the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the Middle East during their 10 years as High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security differ from one another? To what degree were these differences a product of the individual worldviews of these three people, of these three diplomats? To what degree were they motivated by dynamics in EU-US relations and local changes on the ground in the Israeli-Palestinian dynamic? Can you comment on the different approaches, the similarities and differences between Solana, Ashton, and Mogherini in dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian situation?
I would say that they are very small. Sort of my book and the story of the European Union in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not a story of individual leaders. You know, they may come and go. They may be from the right to the center to the left. They have had over the decades, I would say, pretty much the same opinions. And that is also, I think, a takeaway, which is worth mentioning, that there is a standard European narrative about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which especially the Israeli right hates very, very much. And that is that the Arab-Israeli conflict is the key to other conflicts in the Middle East and a solution to that conflict will lead to a lot of other good things in the region. And that is shared widely by politicians across the board, from the right to the center to the left. And all of these three individuals that you mentioned share that worldview. Now, I should say, to be fair here, that this narrative has diminished somehow over the past 10 years, especially the past 5 years since Trump, Brexit, the refugee crisis, the corona pandemic, which means that a lot of other things have taken over the agenda. So Israel-Palestine, as we call it today, instead of the Israeli-Arab conflict, is not at all as dominating as it was a decade or two or three, four decades ago.
To what degree are European and EU decision makers aware of the feelings that many Israelis have regarding the EU's approach to the conflict? To what degree do they understand the sense of resentment that Israelis sometimes feel about the EU's role, the sense of hypocrisy, the sense of misguidedness? To what degree do they understand it? To what degree are they aware of it? To what degree do they get where it's coming from? Or is it something that they ignore, or are they oblivious to? I'm curious, to what degree are EU leaders aware of where its critics are coming from?
I would say that there is greater awareness on that particular issue. And I think it's also important to go back here. I mean, there is a lot of layers of complexities. I mean, starting with, say, the colonialism, Holocaust, you know, in Europe, and sort of European-Jewish relations over a long period of time. So this is part of sort of the luggage that we have here, that we have to unpack. I think it's fair to say that for many decades, both Israeli governments, successive Israeli governments from left to the right, and also sort of the wider Israeli population, they were extremely skeptical about the EU's role here in the conflict, because it was seen as sort of pondering to first an Arab narrative of the conflict and later a Palestinian narrative of the conflict. And one of the reasons why the EU took this position was in order to secure good relations with the OPEC countries after the wars of 1967 and 1973, when the EU depended heavily on oil from the Middle East. Around 50% of the total energy consumption, 80% of the oil imports came from the Middle East at this time. But as the decades went by, and this, I think especially after 9/11, 2001, and also after the refugee crisis and the waves of terrorism that we have had here in Europe, I think that many Europeans, both among the general population and among leaders, have identified, I think, more closely with Israel and less closely with the Palestinian. And of course, the fact that the far right has been rising all over, especially Western Europe, compromising around, say, 20% of the electorate in many countries. This means, of course, a new and very big, powerful pro-Israeli force in Europe.
What role did the 1967 Six-Day War play in stimulating the European Commission's approach to the Israeli-Arab conflict? In what ways is the EU's role since the 1990s similar and or different from the approach taken by the European Commission in the post-1967 years and even the 1970s?
Both of these wars, 1967 and 1973, were watershed events for Europe for different reasons. The 1967 war took place 20 years after World War II. At this time, there wasn't a common European foreign policy, but a lot of people pushed for it in the European Parliament, the European Commission, and in various governments. And people used this crisis and said, here's a major war taking place on the doorsteps of Europe. We need to use this war to unite. We need to use this war to create a foreign policy. There is a political saying that says, never let a good crisis go to waste. So they used this war to create a common European foreign policy. This was sort of, and that's also one of the reasons why it is unique, why it has a sort of special emotional baggage and all of this. So it was used to create a common European foreign policy. And that succeeded. And then the next war took place, 1973, led to the oil crisis. The price of oil went up 400% over a night, led to a major energy crisis in Europe, in the US, and in the whole of the industrialized world. These very high energy prices also led to massive transferring of wealth from the industrialized world to the oil producers in the Middle East, which then resulted in an increase of about 1,000% increase in trade between the EU and the OPEC countries in the 1970s. There were a lot of big things going on here. If we then fast forward the tape to the 1990s, we had the Oslo Agreement, we had the peace process began in Madrid in 1991, continued with the Oslo Agreement in 1993. The EU, for the first time then, got a sort of a role on the ground in setting up Palestinian institutions. First and foremost, setting up the Palestinian Authority, which became sort of the government body in the autonomous Palestinian eras under self-rule. So the EU contributed with around 50% of the whole funding to the Palestinians during the peace process of the 1990s, which of course has continued in some way or form up until this day.
How did the end of the Cold War change European perspectives towards the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
I think it had an enormous role, because I think it's, first of all, it's important to say that the 1980s, it was a very dark decade for the Israeli-Arab conflict. First, it provoked a major war in Lebanon in the early 1980s, and then an intifada in the occupied territories in 1987. So it was very dark. But suddenly, quite fast, at the end of the 80s, it went sort of from very dark to quite optimistic, to a lot of optimism. And a lot of things happened in these years that unleashed the peace process. And the EU's declarations were very important here. The EU had, throughout the 80s, legitimized the two key principles of Oslo, which was mutual recognition and land for peace. These are sort of the two normative formulas that underpins the Oslo framework. And these were legitimized first and most strongly by the EU. At the time, both the Israeli government, the PLO, and the American government were quite critical of these declarations, and later on adopted many of them themselves. And this is what I call normative power, that you can get other actors to adopt your own positions. Now, I'm not saying that it was only because of the EU, but maybe in social sciences there are often many, you know, different factors leading up to, you know, somebody taking a decision. But I think it's fair to say that this was one of the reasons, and that there was a clear normative power involved here. So that was very important.
Can you comment on the EU's response to terrorism during the Oslo years? In your book, you touch on its response to the slaying and assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, its response to the Baruch Goldstein massacre in Hebron in 1994, and to the suicide bombings by Islamic Jihad and Hamas. Can you comment on how the EU handled the terrorism that arose in response to the Oslo Accords?
Yes, absolutely. I think it first is important to say that the worst terror attacks in Israel took place in the 1970s. We have the Coastal Road massacre, Maalot school massacre, Kiryat Shemona terror attack. When these happened at the time, the EU did not condemn them, which is an interesting story in itself. It started condemning terrorism against Israelis slowly in the 1980s, and then it became routine during the peace process of the 1990s. And it sort of, the condemnations became stronger after the second intifada broke out in 2000. So at one point, I think it was in 2002 or so, the EU stated, put out a very strong statement that said that suicide bombings do irreparable damage to the Palestinian cause. And I think that it did in many Europeans' eyes. The solidarity with the Palestinians was in many aspects much stronger before the militant Islamists became the most prominent actor in the Palestinian society. There was, of course, various kind of ideological connections between Fatah and the PLO, and especially social democratic parties in Europe in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and still are. And we don't see, you know, anything comparable vis-a-vis the militant Islamists.
Beyond verbal declarations, what kinds of punishments or sticks, as opposed to carrots, could the EU foreseeably and conceivably implement in the Israeli-Palestinian theater? Would instituting punitive measures against the parties make European policy more effective, or would it be a risk to what would otherwise be available and achievable diplomatically?
It's a great question, and it's a question which is quite difficult to answer. But if I would unpack it, I would sort of start by saying that there is a perception here that the Palestinians are too weak to punish. If you punish the Palestinian Authority too much, it will collapse. It will open up the doors wide open for the Islamists. That is a situation that the EU absolutely wishes to avoid. So it can't punish the Palestinian Authority too hard, because other worse actors would then be empowered. When it comes to Israel, the perception is the complete opposite, that it is too strong to be punished, especially since it is allied so closely with the US. So a too strong punishment of Israel may sort of affect European US transatlantic relations, which is not in the interest of the EU. But with all these things being said, the EU is the largest trading partner to Israel, the largest trading partner to many of the actors involved here. So it has enormous leverage and enormous clout, and it could do all kinds of things. Say, you know, and when it comes to Israel, the big things it can do would be to say, have no longer have visa-free travel of Israelis to Europe. To have sort of the it's called the association agreement, which sort of regulates all kinds of economic dealings, and also the scientific corporation. So these are sort of the three big areas where it can punish Israel on a broad scale. Then there are smaller areas like, say, labeling settlement products, banning settlement products, settlers to travel. So there are all kinds of sticks, from huge sticks to small sticks. But nothing big haven't really been employed. There have been some measures, say, labeling of settlement products, excluding settlements from research cooperation projects, and sometimes sort of banning weapon sales to Israel, say, for example, during the first Lebanon war. But it's also important to say that a lot of these sort of, say, cooperation when it comes to weapons and the intelligence systems and these kind of things have grown much, much closer after the second Intifada and after the waves of terrorism in Europe 5-6 years ago. But I mean, for example, 20 years ago, European policymakers criticized Israel for building the barrier wall in the West Bank and on Israel's border with the West Bank. And today, of course, some European states are building their own walls. So this is just an example of how the, both the discourse and the reality on the ground have shifted. On the Palestinians side, they could punish the Palestinians in all kinds of ways. They have, of course, boycotted the Hamas government in Gaza. And we can have a discussion whether that was a wise thing to do or not. There have been three wars in Gaza, or four wars in Gaza, since the Hamas took power there. And it can also punish the Palestinian Authority, but it doesn't really want to do that because it would make a bad situation even worse.
One initiative that was attempted during the 1990s was the European Mediterranean Partnership. Can you explain what was envisioned in the Euro-Mediterranean Partnership? What came of it? What lessons do you see as relevant for thinking about this initiative in the context of EU-Middle East relations?
Yeah, it was an initiative that sort of materialized after Oslo. And we should keep in mind today that the Oslo sort of process was a multilateral process with sort of five different tracks: Israel versus the PLO, Israel Jordan, Israel Syria, Israel Lebanon, and Israel of the wider Arab world. And on these tracks, it was only the Jordanian track that fully succeeded. And now, with the Abraham Accords, we see that sort of Israel and the sort of the wider Arab world track is materializing with this new peace agreement. But the idea of the Euro-Mediterranean partnership was that sort of to have bilateral relations between the EU and all of these countries, and also having them meeting at the same time in various forums. And it worked for a while, and this means, of course, in having Israel and Syria and all these kind of actors, Israel, Lebanon, talking to each other. One of the reasons why it didn't really move forward was that the Oslo peace process was stuck after a couple of years. So it was impossible sort of to deepen Israel's relations any further with Lebanon and Syria and some of the other countries involved. And now, of course, peace process and peace negotiations took place with Syria basically all the way up to the civil war broke out there, with a lot of problems in between. But nothing much really came out in the end of these projects, but they looked promising for a while.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
How did the war on terrorism, as an international American-led endeavor, and the 9/11 attacks, coupled with the events of the 2000s, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Intifada, the Bush administration, terrorist attacks in Madrid and London, what role did the war on terrorism play in influencing EU policy toward the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
I think it had a tremendous effect on many different levels. And I think, and I alluded to one of the effects earlier, I think it led to a shift in a much more pro-Israeli conception within the EU and in a much less pro-Palestinian conception. I know that that is not the fact, that's not how many Israelis feel, and I know that and I respect it. But I think that the data shows it, and I can see that, for example, very clearly in my material, that there is a shift towards sort of embracing Israel and condemning the Palestinians much harder within the framework of the war on terrorism. And of course, it led to, for example, you know, placing Hamas on a terrorist list. It created, you know, all kinds of sort of conceptions of security that I think favored Israel. So I think that it led to a pro-Israeli shift in the EU's declaration, even if it's not the way that many people feel. But I think it is a fact if one actually look at what has been said. And another thing is important. It also, I think, mainstreamed for a while the idea of a Palestinian state, because that had been anathema in the 1990s. So I think it's also fair to say, especially here in Europe, a lot of people saw the Palestine question, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as one of the reasons, not the only one, but one of the reasons behind the war on terrorism, behind 9/11, and also sort of one of the solutions. You know, Bush came up with the idea of a Palestinian state, you know, right after 9/11, you know, a month after 9/11. It wasn't a coincidence. It had to do with sort of, you know, with winning the war on terrorism. Now, it never materialized, but it was a very powerful idea during the first decade of the 2000s that the Palestinian state would be established. It culminated in 2011 in the UN, but when it wasn't established.
Why was Europe optimistic about President Barack Obama's vision toward the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? What role did Obama's policy play, Obama's policy towards the Israeli-Palestinian situation play in US-European relations? Can you comment on the triangular relationship between President Barack Obama, the EU, and the Middle East conflict, in the Middle East situation between 2008 and 2016?
There was enormous hope here in Europe about Barack Obama. And one of the reasons for that was that many saw him as a European. And people said quite openly that he has sort of a European mentality. He has a European conception, both of the world and when it comes to multilateralism and when it came to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He and his closest advisors shared this, what I call the European twin standard narrative about the conflict. Arab-Israeli conflict, most important, and solving that will lead, is sort of the key to solving other problems in the Middle East. That was what Barack Obama believed. And that was why he was embraced so much by the Europeans in the beginning. What is interesting to see sort of afterwards is that basically everybody agree that Barack Obama was a complete failure when it comes to Middle East peacemaking. Sort of, you know, Israelis, Palestinians from left to right, from, you know, secular to religious, everybody agree that he was a complete failure.
What would you make of Trump's approach to the Middle East in the subsequent years from, you know, 2016, 2017 onward? How did Europe respond to some of the key policies of President Trump in the Middle East? The Abraham Accords, his hostile posture towards Iran, recognizing Jerusalem and the Golan Heights as being under Israeli sovereignty. Can you comment on the EU's approach to Trump?
Yeah, first of all, I think it's fair to say that a lot of Europeans, both sort of states and the EU as an organization, and many European individuals were very afraid of Trump, because, I mean, he had, you know, he was in favor of splitting up the European Union, for example. So there was a lot of fear for him, and I think he enjoyed being feared. He took the opposite approach after a while. And that is called the outside-in approach, meaning Israeli-Arab normalization first, Israeli-Palestinian peace later, which is, of course, the exact opposite narrative to that of the EU. European policymakers said, well, you know, with this guy in the beginning, there is 1% chance that he will solve the conflict, 1%, because he is so different and maybe a little bit crazy and irrational and all of that. And for, in, you know, in the beginning, it was a little bit unclear what he was going to do, because he was sort of for and against and in between on many issues like settlements and other things. After a year or so, I think it became clear that he was very, very pro-Israeli, and he did a lot of things. He moved the embassy. He recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital. He also recognized the annexation of the Golan Heights. He closed down the Palestinian mission in Washington. He closed down the Palestinian consulate in Jerusalem. He cut off aid, of course, pulled the U.S. out of the Iranian nuclear agreement. And he did a lot of these things, and basically none of them had the support of the Europeans. So that was, I think, a radical break. And of course, the most consequential, so many of these issues were quite symbolic, I would say. Say, for example, the embassy move. It's a, you know, it's a very small embassy. The, you know, the former embassy in Tel Aviv is still there. No one has followed him on the Golan Heights. I don't see any states in the pipeline doing so. Most governments here in Europe still support the Palestinian Authority. So some of it was sort of more symbolic. But pulling out the U.S. from the JCPOA, the Iranian nuclear agreement, was the big thing. And that is, of course, one big, big challenge today. And if you read the Israeli press carefully, I think there have been a lot of articles over the past couple of weeks saying very clearly that especially the Israeli military, if it would like to go back to the deal, even if it's not perfect. And I think that there are hints that the present government under Bennett and Lapid would also like to do it, even if they cannot really say it explicitly yet. We should, of course, keep in mind that Israeli politicians over decades have invested so much time and energy and political capital in stopping Iran from ever getting to a nuclear weapon. And now it seems like they are closer than ever. And that, of course, raises, I think, serious question marks about both, say, the whole approach of Trump and Netanyahu to this.
How did the EU's global strategy for security and policy come to be? How did the summer 2016 statements of the EU differ from previous and subsequent global strategy declarations?
Yeah, it came, as you said, in the summer of 2016, just before Donald Trump was elected. So it became, I think it's fair to say, irrelevant quite fast, because we had Trump, we had Brexit, we had the pandemic. So a lot of major things happened right after it was published. The key concept of the global strategy is resilience, which I think is a good concept to use both sort of theoretically and empirically in the world that we are living in today. Resilience is a great concept. And part of the story here is that we talked a lot about the rise of China, but it is happening, you know, at the expense of Europe. So the decline of Europe is a big part of the rise of China. And I see that, for example, in my courses, when I look at sort of economic data, we see that Europe's relative weight in when it comes to, say, global GDP is smaller than before. We have much lower growth than especially China, and even lower than the US. So we are becoming, you know, increasingly weaker. And I think one can see that as well if one looks at the EU's policies vis-a-vis the Israeli-Palestinian conflict over the past 5 years. So not much have come out of the EU's global strategy, but I think it's fair to say that sort of big events overshadowed it, from Trump to Brexit to the pandemic.
Wow. You alluded to China just now. How does the increasingly multipolar global geopolitical environment influence Europe's approach to the Middle East? As the Middle East becomes a more competitive multipolar environment, with China and Russia being more actively involved, what influence does this have on Europe's approach? Does it make Europe more dependent on the US, more assertive in trying to take an independent policy, more deferent to national governments such as major powers like France, Britain, Germany? Can you comment on this? In a multipolar environment, does this make Europe more reliant on creative and ambitious diplomatic initiatives, or does it undercut them?
Yeah, good question. And I think the big argument would be that it is definitely weakening the EU. So for the past 5 years, the EU has not been able to put out a single united statement from the foreign ministers on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Nothing. So that is, I think, telling of the very weak position of the European Union at the moment. So that means that especially the government of Israel is dealing more and more with individual European countries like France and Germany and Sweden bilaterally. And that's also a strategy by Israel of sort of, you know, separating these countries from each other in order to get a more favorable outcome from negotiating with individual countries rather than with the EU as a bloc. And as you said, the more and more sort of international actors are either engaging when it comes to China, or re-engaging when it comes to Russia with the Middle East, but not so much with Israel-Palestine, to be honest. Russia and China don't really have strong roles here, except for in the UN Security Council, where they, of course, regularly vote against everything that either the US or Israel propose on this conflict. And there is a lot of hypocrisy involved here. Let's be from all sides. Let's be honest and say that. Basically, sort of the only human rights issues and commissions that China and Russia support are those against Israel. Whereas, in all other cases, they talk about state sovereignty and non-intervention and these kind of issues, except for Israel. Whereas most European countries and the US supports the same kind of initiatives in most places, except for when it comes to Israel. So here you see, of course, how the conflict is spreading to all over the world and affecting, all kinds of actors. And, people can throw accusations of hypocrisy in all kinds of directions with, with good reasons. So, but they aren't that active in Israel, Palestine, Russia, and China. Yes, Russia, of course, has a very big role to play in Syria and vis-a-vis Iran. And China may build up capacity in the future, but we are not there yet.
How has the transition from President Trump to President Biden, from Prime Minister Netanyahu to Prime Minister Bennett, and from High Representative Mogherini to High Representative Borrell for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy changed the dynamic in recent months, years and months?
Well, I think it's fair to say that all developments have been warmly welcomed here in Europe, especially the first two. I think most Europeans, and especially European governments, especially those in Western Europe, warmly embraced Biden. Not because anyone is particularly fond of him, but a lot of people here genuinely feared what a second Trump administration would have meant for, say, democracy in the world, multilateralism, standing of the European Union, NATO, and all these kind of things, which, of course, are much bigger issues than Israel-Palestine. So for those reasons, most heads of states and governments warmly embrace Biden. Even if I think it's fair to say that I can't think of anyone, any analyst or anyone else who thinks that Biden will solve anything that has to do with Israel-Palestine. So there is, absolutely no optimism at all that he will do anything here. Bennett and his new government has also been warmly embraced, not as much as Biden, but genuinely warmly embraced. And that's that is because of a couple of interesting reasons. I think Israel provides an interesting case how you can get away with an incumbent populism that is very difficult to get away with, this sort of broad rainbow coalition of everybody against Netanyahu is, I think, an example that others will look like, because we have a form of an 8-party coalition government in Israel, which is almost record. There was a 9-party government once in Italy in the 1990s, but this is sort of the second most parties in a government ever anywhere in the world. So that is impressive. Many here in Europe are also impressed that the Israeli electorate managed to oust Netanyahu peacefully with democratic elections. So these are some of the reasons why a lot of people, myself included, are impressed by the new government in Israel. And because it has put Israel on a different trajectory, and who knows where it will end.
Do you have any conjectures as to how European involvement in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict might evolve in the new decade of the 2020s? What insights can you share on European policy towards the conflict since you completed writing your book? And is there anything our listeners can take away in regard to how to think about the future of EU relations with both Israel and the Palestinians?
Yeah, there are a couple of things that I think that are well worth mentioning. We are also living now in very pessimistic times, just like the 1980s, which was, as I said before, it was a complete dark decade. And suddenly it opened up, you know, rays of lights and hope with the beginning of the peace process that very few people saw coming beforehand. So we should never sort of underestimate the possibilities for change, whether bad or good, for whatever reasons. We should always be sort of be optimistic and open that things can change in whatever direction. That, I think, is one key lesson. Another lesson is that we here in Europe have strongly underestimated the cost of state collapses in governance structures in the Middle East and their enormous cost for Europe. I'm thinking of Libya, I'm thinking of Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and other countries, Lebanon too, to today. We have strongly underestimated the costs when it comes to refugee flows. And of course, we realize now that, you know, if your neighbor's house is on fire, you are not safe yourself. And absolutely, we are very, very close to the Middle East, which is a big difference from the American point of view. And in light of this development, I think it's clear that we will do our utmost to keep the Palestinian Authority in place, however imperfect it may be, however, you know, corrupted it may be, simply to avoid further collapses in governance structures, further destabilizations of the region, and refugee flows. So I think that is, you know, something which I think is clear will happen. When it comes to, say, sort of to the level of discourses and the normative development, there are a lot of sort of new terminologies entering into the debate, which I think will be part of the future. Discussions on, say, you know, apartheid, settler colonialism, this kind of radical terminology that partly comes from the progressive forces in the US. It used to be that sort of Europe influenced America and America's debate on Israel-Palestine, but I see something coming here in the other direction. So a lot of these discussions will, I think, be part of the future. And of course, the biggest question of all here is that if there won't be a two-state solution, what will be there instead? And that is not just sort of a development on the ground. It is also a discussion of political theorists, and it has to do with, you know, all kinds of new terminology and concepts that needs to be legitimized and mainstreamed.
As we bring our interview today to a close, the final question I'd like to ask you is, what are you working on now or next as your subsequent research project?
I'm turning 40 next year, so I've been thinking a lot of what I'm going to do. Thank you. I've been thinking a lot of what I'm going to do between 40 and 50, and I hope that this will be sort of my strongest decade. And I'm actually preparing a quite big research application on how the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has affected anti-Semitism in my own country, because it's very clear that the Middle Eastern conflicts are being played out in Europe today. And we have seen this with Israel-Palestine for a while now. And we may see the same thing with Syria and Syrian refugees in the future as well. So I think these are important topics to study.
Great. That would be absolutely fascinating. Such an important contribution that will be, as your current book is and has indeed been. Thank you so much for the erudition and effort and investment that went into producing this wonderful monograph and this fascinating book.
Thank you, Ari. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure to be on your show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been an honor to have this dialogue with you. Thank you for your time, and thank you for such a detailed response to the questions asked.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. To our listeners, this has been Dr. Anders Persson, Associate Professor of Political Science at Linnaeus University. We have been discussing his recent book, EU Diplomacy and the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, 1967 to 2019, published by Edinburgh University Press, 2020. Thank you very much.